This episode is brought to you by the AIA Film Challenge. Let architecture inspire your next short for a chance to win $5,000 in a screening at the Architecture and Design Film Festival in New York. The fourth annual AIA Film Challenge invites filmmakers to team with architects and share stories of architects and civic leaders designing a better future for our communities. Register today at AIAFilmChallenge.org. That's AIAFilmChallenge.org. Welcome to Indie Film Weekly, a No Film School podcast. I'm John Fusco.
I'm Eric Lewis.
And I'm Charles Hain.
It is July 12th, 2018. And on this week's show, Netflix is spending billions more dollars, how to properly use a green screen, and the 25 coolest festivals in the whole wide world. Hey everybody, we are here from downtown Brooklyn, and Liz is not here this week.
No. She is out. It was her birthday on Tuesday, so happy birthday, Liz.
Happy birthday, Liz!
And as a result, we suspended her for the week. She didn't know much about some of the Stephen King films, so we sent her on a vacation to watch them all.
She needed a week to catch up on the Stephen King films.
She had to read It, and that's going to take at least a week. Yeah. So we said, take the birthday.
That's fine.
And we're talking about the films of director Stephen King, known for...
Maximum Overdrive?
Yes.
Oh, God, no. I wouldn't put that on her. It's her birthday week. We can't make her watch that.
Happy birthday, Liz.
Anyways, while she's off enjoying her life somewhere, we're stuck here in the booth. I'm just kidding. It's great to be here. I always get a bum rap for being negative. So, you know what? I am so happy to be with you guys today.
It sounds like he's being sarcastic, but I swear to God, guys, John's actually in a good mood.
I got a real big smile on my face, and I can't wait to tell everyone the news.
And speaking of that news, there was a movie that came out last Christmas from Ridley Scott called All the Money in the World. And while I'm unsure of how much money actually does exist in the world, there's a very good chance that Netflix has most of it. The streaming service, and yes, still a DVD by mail service, says my parents, is reported to have spent $12 to $13 billion on content by the conclusion of 2018. I feel like that's a lot of money.
So wait, is that 12 like over its life or $12 billion in 2018?
2018
just the year, the calendar year of 2018.
What?
Yeah, so regarding Netflix originals, such as our colleague Ryan Koo's recent debut feature, Amateur, Netflix will have released 83 original films by year's end. Compare that to other large studios like Warner Brothers, which will have put out 23, and Disney, which will have put out only 10. Netflix is putting out an original film more than once a week. TV-wise, which also Netflix is huge in, Netflix will have put out 700 series by the end of the year. So 100 of those are scripted. So that could be the comedies, dramas, etc. And the 700 also includes stand-up comedy specials and nonfiction episodics that are really huge on Netflix as well. So it's just so much money and so many series and films coming out every single Friday. And does more equal better or does more equal more? Netflix doesn't release viewership numbers to the general public. I believe they do to the filmmakers themselves. But it will be interesting to see over the next year or two if the company can keep up this pace. And it's also interesting to see what the company will pick up at TIFF or New York Film Festival or Telluride this year, as I'm sure they'll want to stay in the Oscar race again after winning Best Documentary for Icarus last year and netting 4 nominations for Mudbound. So we'll see what they acquire, too, as the festival season kicks into high gear.
Yeah, so Ryan actually told us that they do share the numbers with the filmmakers, but like those filmmakers are under strict
secrecy.
Prohibition.
Yeah,
secrecy to not release those numbers. So Ryan won't even tell us how well his movie did. But it's also interesting to note that, you know, last year they had Icarus and Mudbound, and this year they haven't really made any acquisitions.
No, not yet. I guess Icarus was a Sundance one, and so was Mudbound, actually.
Yeah, they were both Sundance.
Yeah, and did they pick up anything big at Sundance? Maybe that, I think there was that Tamara Jenkins, Paul Giamatti movie. I don't know. It hasn't been released yet, but I think that may have been something, but it's been very quiet.
Yeah, I remember how we had a few guests on the show who were talking about how scarce of a year it was for these streaming platforms after, like, a tremendous upswing in the past 5 years.
Yeah.
And it's because Netflix is making so much original content. But it's interesting to think that the things that are actually like getting prestige are acquisitions and not like originally produced content.
And I think we also talked about Out of Sundance, how they were using festivals like Sundance and South By as festivals to premiere their original content. So Stupid and Futile Gesture.
Yeah,
right?
that was a Netflix original
just happened to use Sundance as a platform to premiere at and stream 3 days later. You know,
Legacy of a White-Tailed Deer is one that they had at South by Southwest.
The Six Balloons.
Yeah, Six Balloons. Yeah. I saw that at South by too.
So they seem to be using it for their original films,
right?
In a way.
Well, speaking about film festivals, I don't know if you've noticed, but every week on this show, we have an entire segment dedicated to highlighting a few festival deadlines that we think our listeners, you guys, should pay attention to. And I'm usually the one who murks through all of the hundreds and thousands of festivals available for you to submit to via Film Freeway and Without a Box. And over the past couple years, I've set some criteria for which ones make the cut for our show. Generally, I'll be sure and include any festival that is Academy Award qualifying, which means, you know, if your short wins, then it will be entered into the Academy nomination pool, or if the film festival is included on one of Movie Maker Magazine's list of 50 film festivals worth the entry fee, or 25 coolest film festivals in the world. Now, sometimes I get made fun of by my coworkers for doing so, and some of them ask, who are we to trust Movie Maker Magazine?
Or the 3M, as we call it around here?
Triple M.
Never actually said that before.
We'll call it that from now on, because it's a bit of a mouthful. Well, I did a little more research into how exactly these festivals are selected, and it turns out that the magazine actually puts together a panel of reputable journalists, publicists, filmmakers, programmers, and screenwriters who vote on the list and end up creating the final compilation. So it's not really like a Movie Maker Magazine sponsored list.
Right.
Which I think maybe was what some of the worry was for.
Sourced from the outside.
It's
industry.
The world.
I thought it was funded by like the Koch brothers or something.
Right, exactly. So that being said, this week, Movie Maker Magazine, or Triple M, put out their selections for 2018's 25 coolest film festivals in the world. And I thought I might as well go ahead and share them with you in no particular order because, well, actually, it isn't a particular
alphabetical
order.
Alphabetical.
It's alphabetical. So listen quick because I'm going to say I'm really fast. So these are the 25. AFI Fest, where the people who made a 30,000 euro film from Albania get the same treatment as the ones who made a big co-production with movie stars. AFI Silver, which is the European Union Film Showcase. The American Black Film Festival, where, quote, you'll be hard-pressed to find a sexier location than Miami Beach, especially in June, according to one panelist.
I mean, location matters at these things.
AnimaFest Zagreb, which is a Croatian animated film festival that many consider to be the best of its kind in the world. The Bahamas International Film Festival, because who doesn't want to be in the Bahamas in December? Bam! CinemaFest made it, which is pretty cool. And we're pretty sure it's because it's down the street from the No Film School offices that it made it. The Big Ears Festival, which is Tennessee's answer to South by Southwest. I've never heard of that festival.
I've heard of it, but I don't know what the Big Ears is representation of.
I think Big Ears is a park, right? Isn't it Big Ears State Park or something?
Maybe, yeah. Okay. It takes place in the Smoky Mountains, and I guess it started as a music festival like South by Southwest did.
Gotcha.
Oh, I'm thinking of Barriers. There's no Big Ears Park in Tennessee.
No Big Ears?
Yeah.
Dumbo is the executive director. I have no idea.
Dumbo will be premiering there next year.
Yeah, Tim Burton is the keynote.
Capital City Film Festival, the Chicago International Film Festival, which we mentioned quite a bit. Frameline, which is San Francisco's most LGBT-friendly film festival, which is saying quite a lot. IFF Boston, IFF Rotterdam. The Lighthouse International Film Festival, which surprised me because New Jersey has one of the coolest film festivals in the world.
Wow.
Good for New Jersey. Milwaukee LGBT Film Festival, the Olympia Film Festival, Pride of the Ocean Film Festival, which is an, quote, LGBT film festival at sea that, interestingly enough, often takes place on a cruise ship full of drunken Republican heterosexuals.
So wait, are they there for the festival or this film festival takes over the boat in which these Republicans are vacationing?
I think they're there for the festival. I don't know. Okay. When I was reading the article, it said that if the ship had gone down, then Trump wouldn't have won the election.
So, I love the idea that a whole bunch of like Republican heterosexuals are like, ooh, Pride of the Ocean. I bet that's going to be some boat films. Let's go see some boat films. I don't know why that was Minnesota in the accent.
But it does sound actually like the most progressive film festival on this list when you really get down to it.
Definitely the most progressive film festival for a body of water on this list.
We need to have more film festivals on a cruise ship.
Yeah. The Provincetown International Film Festival, Rooftop Films made it, and we've singled out that one a lot of times because they're some of our friends, and we like to go to their screenings during the summer. They're great. The San Francisco International Film Festival made it, Sarasota Film Festival, the Sonoma International Film Festival, which takes place in the heart of California's wine country and features a five-course meal surrounding an evening of the best food-centric short films, which is pretty cool, the TLV Fest in Tel Aviv, True False Film Fest, Urban World, and rounding out the list, the Zurich Film Festival.
Congrats, Zurich.
Zurich, you made it.
So these will be the next 25 mentioned on the podcast for
the next year. Yeah, so maybe
2018.
You'll hear these deadlines later on in the year or next year or however many years I'm still making these festival announcements.
I mean, it looks like the big controversy is the snub of No Hot Springs.
No Hot Springs.
No Hot Springs this year. They went down in coolness, I guess.
They went down, yeah.
It's a shame.
It's a little too hot.
It's too hot in Arkansas.
So we also have some bad news this week for people who are both fans of Nicholas Winding Refn and cinema, because you may just have to choose one or the other. Nicholas Winding Refn has officially proclaimed cinema as dead.
I mean, is Only God Forgives the movie that killed it?
Yeah. What was the cause of death?
One of my friends actually likes that movie a lot, and I haven't seen it because I keep hearing terrible things about it, except from my one friend who's also my editor.
I mean, I'm in general a Nicholas Winding Refn fan, but Only God Forgives is maybe unforgivable, even by God.
Wow.
I'm not a huge fan. I Bronson let me down. Drive, I love for the music, but not the actual film itself. Albert Brooks is good in it, but I'm not a huge fan.
What about The Neon Demon?
Oh, I missed that.
You didn't see the Neon Demon?
I forgot about Neon Demon. No, I wanted to because it had such an awesome trailer with the tiger and all the blood and stuff, and I totally missed it.
It's very Nicholas Winding Refn.
Oh, I'm out.
I'll give it
that. I'm not doing it. Okay, done.
Anyways, there is some good news for those of you that do like Winding Refn because you can subscribe to his new VOD service, which offers up some of his favorite cult films, and they're going to be 100% free. The Guardian reports buynwr.com is set to launch later this July, and Refn celebrated his upcoming website debut by telling the publication the first four films that will be made available to stream. Refn handpicked Curtis Harrington's Night Tide, Burt Williams's The Nest of the Cuckoo Birds, Ron Orman's The Burning Hell, and Dale Barry's Hot Thrills and Warm Chills. Do you guys know any of those?
I may have heard of Night Tide, but I have not seen any of these four.
Well, now you can...
By the end of July, I will have.
Thanks to Winding Refn. The filmmaker explained the reason for creating a website by saying, quote, "Over recent years, I've bought and had restored scores of old movies as a hobby. I wondered what to do with them." And I think he means scores as in, like, a multitude, not the actual audio. That's some tricky wordplay, Winding Refn. You dog. Then I realized I should share them for free, so I set up a website where they could be streamed. There's no catch. You're not being sold anything. Take it or leave it. End quote. The bad news is that in a recent tour promoting his website, of course, as I mentioned, the auteur also proclaimed cinema to be dead. Quote, "Cinema is dead," Refn said. "I have come to Lyon to declare film to be dead, and now it's resurrected. Film clings on to our feet as we move forward. The best way to move forward is to bury the past. That doesn't mean you forget it." End quote. And how is it being resurrected? Why, single-handedly by Refn through his new website, of course. Wow. Television, however, will not have the same such fortune. Refn said, quote, "Television is dead and television will not be reborn. It will not come back. What has surfaced instead is the digital platform of entertainment. Cinema will come back with different meaning, but television is dead." Ironically, Refn's next directorial effort will be Amazon's new television series, Too Old to Die Young, which will debut sometime in 2019. So
he's resurrecting television too. This is easy. You claim something's dead and then you make something new.
Refn is the great resurrector.
So he is Lazarus?
Yes.
Or he is Jesus and cinema is Lazarus.
Yes, yeah.
I also like that you call him Winding Refn because it sounds like something you would do on a sailboat. You're like, I can't hoist the sail. I'm Winding Refn over here.
Is it Winding Refn?
I don't know.
Winding?
I don't know.
Is it Nicholas Winding Refn?
Might be. I mean, that's, it's like he's going to say, like, food is dead, but my new restaurant will be opening in January. Come on.
Look, three people are talking about it. Marketing is alive.
Well, let's see how many people get on that website for those four blockbuster titles.
And how many people see his new TV show, too? We'll see.
That's true.
In Amazon.
Good point. Now that TV is dead.
Yeah. Amazon's getting really good stuff.
It is. Movies, too.
And in some sadder but tributary news, we want to pay our respects to two gentlemen who passed away last week, who were both titans in their respective corners of cinema. Nicknamed the Master of Light, Dutch cinematographer Robbie Mueller died at the age of 78. Mueller was known for his work with Lars von Trier, primarily, on Breaking the Waves and Dancer in the Dark, and with Jim Jarmusch on films like Ghost Dog and Dead Man, while also working with Wim Wenders on Paris, Texas, and shooting Alex Cox's Repo Man. And so he passed away at the age of 78, so rest in peace, Robbie. And master documentarian Claude Lanzmann also passed away last week at the age of 92. The French filmmaker and journalist, he didn't actually make his first film until turning 48, is of course most highly regarded for his 9-hour-long documentary Shoah, which took over 11 years to make. I saw this film in college, or at the very least segments of it, and it's truly a fascinating experience as Lanzmann goes back to the areas of occupation and destruction of World War II and speaks with the men and women there today, well, as of 1985, who were affected by or complicit with the Nazi occupation. Rather than have archival footage bringing to mind the Holocaust imagery that we've seen in history classes as we grew up through the school system, Lanzmann lets the contemporary words create a horrific picture all its own. Lanzmann was still making movies up to last year. I believe he had something premiere at Cannes 2017, and it's very sad to see him go.
Man, 92, and he was still making movies.
Yeah,
and I think he fought in the resistance during World War II. So I think he went from being a youthful resistance fighter to being a filmmaker.
Yeah, it's been he had a really interesting life, and Liz wrote the obit for that we posted on the site too. So it's definitely had a big career even before turning to filmmaking.
Great. Well, let's move on to gear news. Charles, what do we got this week?
Hey, everybody. So this week in tech and gear news, well, a lot of the data security news lately has been like personal data, like Facebook and Twitter and all of that stuff getting leaked. It's important to remember that business and creative data gets hacked, too. Even if you're like punk rock and don't care about business, you're going to care if it's your business. So if it's like your work in progress and it gets leaked publicly, that'll be really annoying. It was only last year that episodes of Orange is the New Black were leaked by the Soundhouse when hackers made it into their server through an old Windows 7 machine they had on their network. These hackers weren't even targeting like film companies. They were just randomly searching the entire internet for Windows 7 machines they could hack into. And then they lucked into Orange is the New Black and were able to try and blackmail HBO with it. To that end, Frame.io is continuing their commitment to ensuring the security of your works in progress with a new set of certifications from the American Association of Certified Public Accountants, which is an amazing thing, like imagining their meetings. And working with the new head of security they brought on last year, Frame.io is putting a big emphasis on staying very active, working to keep your media private. So this is clearly driven by high-end clients like Marvel movies and HBO that if they're using Frame.io, they really want to avoid leaks. But all of that security trickles down to the rest of us and is definitely appreciated even if you are working on something that maybe not millions want to see, but you still don't want to share your rough cuts. Along with this, there's a new auto watermarking tool, which I'm personally really excited about. So watermarking is when you put like words on your thing so like people know it's a work in progress or that it's not the final thing, or you put your company logo on it. It's also one of those things that like gets forgotten so often at 4 a.m. when people are trying to do last minute exports and the watermarking is slowing their exporting down, or they forget to hit a button. And having it as like a blanket project-wide setting in Frame.io will be so nice, because it means you don't have to constantly be making sure everyone on the team knows when to watermark and when not to. You can control it at the like project level in Frame.io. That's cool. On top of that, they've also added asset lifecycle management, which means you can set files to expire after a certain duration. This is super great because, like, let's say there is a breach, and, like, it might not be Frame.io's fault. Like, maybe one of your clients leaves the laptop open at Starbucks and somebody, like, sits down and starts downloading stuff. Like, breaches can happen in all sorts of ways. But how frustrating it would be if, like, a breach happened and the stuff that got stolen was, like, two-month-old stuff that you should have already deleted anyway. Like, stuff where you're like, I meant to delete that. That would be so painful to me. So the ability to set a deadline and have it auto-delete is super useful and appreciated from Frame.io. Continuing on with things happening automatically, we got to dive a little deeper into a tool we first heard about back at NAB, the automated QC tool QScan from EditShare. So QC, if you haven't had to go through it, is like the final step in post before you deliver your project to a broadcast network or a streamer. Netflix, HBO, NBC, they all have these spec sheets of how they need their projects delivered, and you generally need to get a QC report from a QC house certifying that you've hit the technical targets. Now, since post often runs a hair late, it's not uncommon that this process happens super last minute. It's not uncommon to see people paying extra to have the QC house stay open late the night before you deliver and run a QC, and then you might get that back at like midnight after paying all sorts of extra to do a night QC, and then you still have things you've got to fix because you failed parts of it. With QScan, which is working really hard to be certified by those platforms, they're working with Netflix, they're working with other broadcast standards to make sure that their software is up to snuff, you can run that QC yourself on your PC in your facility. It's like roughly real time or even faster than real time. You get that report, no need to send a courier with the file, no need to pay a rush fee. You read the report, you can see how you did, you find an error, you can fix it, you can run it again, checking only that parameter, not the whole thing. It comes with built-in templates for all the various networks. They're working really hard with Netflix on Netflix's IMF delivery format, which we've talked about quite a bit here. Now, cheapest option's $4,000, which is pricey if you're only delivering like a movie once a year. But if you're a little production company, a little post house, and you're delivering stuff regularly, that actually seems like a very fair price to me. Last up this week, a big update from Kino, the footage organization software. If you haven't used it, Kino is all about organizing lots of media before you take it into an edit. This way, you can get a handle on like all of the bad shots and get rid of them before bringing them into the NLE. You can also tag it with metadata. You can pull keyframes. You can do a lot more in Kino before you start your edit to make your edit less painful. Now, Kino's traditionally had the strongest connection with Premiere and Final Cut 10, and that continues with this update. Like, there's a new ability where you can drag and drop. You can, like, organize all your media in Kino and then drag that structure right into Final Cut 10 and it rolls over. But on top of that, they're rolling out a whole bunch of new tools for Media Composer, including the ability to directly write in the preferred MXF format that plays natively in Media Composer. Considering that Kino is like a super powerful tool set for lots of footage, which is something you see a lot in doc work, and doc work is still a very media composer heavy area, it's really great to see Kino working harder to be a tool to feed stuff into media composer projects.
Great. Thanks, Charles. Let's just move right on to Ask No Film School. This week, Mike Halleck asks, does anyone have a strong opinion one way or the other as far as using a green screen or a blue screen for keying in post?
Mike, I'm actually going to use this as a launch pad to talk about some things I like to constantly repeat about green screen, and then I'll answer your question at the end. It's like burying the lead so you stay interested. So, the thing I always try and tell everyone who's about to build a green screen space is that the screen needs to be way bigger than you think. I see folks like trying to build a green screen in their garage all the time, and this green screen is way too small to be useful. The key here is that in order to avoid green bounce off the screen onto your actors, you need to get the actors further away from the screen, right? If the screen's 20 feet by 20 feet, you probably need them 20 to 25 feet or at least 15 feet away from the screen to avoid bounce. And as you get further from the screen, it gets relatively smaller in the background. If your stage is big enough, you can back the camera further off, use a longer lens, and that'll flatten the space out a little bit. So you need the longest space you can get and the biggest green screen you can get to give yourself the most flexibility. So with green screens, bigger is really better. And if you can, try and lay it out so that your actors can get as far away as you can. This is why on a lot of big movies, you'll see like behind the scenes photos or articles where it's like green screen day exterior, where they have like a multi-hundred feet green screen leaning against a warehouse and they're doing it outside. It lets them get the camera and the actors further away, which is going to make it easier to cut clean keys. Second, and I know this is fading, but I still got to say it, please try and avoid 420 capture if at all possible. You want to shoot something raw or 444 or 422 at the worst. 420 creates a lot of chroma crosstalk and it makes for chattering keys. There are special like tools in like Boris Spectralite and stuff that make it easier to do a key with 420, but come on, let's just try and capture 422 or 444 if we can. Now, finally, your actual question, blue or green? That's all up to your subject. Green is commonly used because it's like the least common clothing color, right? Between like I'm looking in this room right now and I'm wearing a blue shirt. John's wearing a blue shirt. We have a blue hat and blue jeans on Eric. Like blue is just a very common wardrobe color. And then red, the third of the three primaries in the additive system, is very close to human skin tone. So green gets chosen a lot because it's the other primary that shows up the least often in clothing. But if you were doing a Green Lantern movie, you're going to have people in green costumes, so you might end up doing blue screen work. If you have a scene with Superman fighting Green Lantern, and so you have blue outfits and green outfits, you might even consider red screen, although that's pretty rare. You do use it sometimes.
What about Superman's red cape?
Ooh! Well, damn. That's when you pay Roto. That's when you like pay people to individually draw a thing around the cape in every frame. I forgot about the red cape. Good call. Also, and I'm just going to throw this out there, most screens get repainted all the time. So like if I bid a green screen or a white psych job, I always include a pre-paint and a post-paint in the bid. Yes, technically the other job before me should have post-painted, so I should be walking into a clean screen. That often doesn't happen. So like finding the $300 or whatever the stage charges to like paint it fresh before you get there and then paint it again after you leave is probably worth it. So you can go back and forth between green and blue. And if you're renting this out to clients, be sure to offer that as a service so they can choose as they want.
Awesome. Thanks, Charles.
My pleasure.
And now on to some movies opening this week. On HBO, you can catch The Battle of the Sexes on July 14th. This was one of last year's big festival films that never really quite took off once it hit the mainstream. The film is directed by Jonathan Dayton and Valerie Faris, and it premiered at TIFF during the fall. It retells the true story of the 1973 tennis match between world number one Billie Jean King and ex-champ and serial hustler Bobby Riggs. This was the first major battle of the sexes in tennis of its kind. Both Steve Carell and Emma Stones were nominated for Golden Globes for their performances as Bobby Riggs and Billie Jean King, respectively, and the movie also features Andrea Riseborough, who should be in every movie next year, and also plays the titular character of Mandy in a movie called Mandy that's coming out later this year. I haven't heard of that one.
That sounds good. I haven't seen Battle of the Sexes either. I wanted to because it's the reunion of Steve Carell and his Little Miss Sunshine directors. It didn't come and go, but it didn't play, as you said, as big of an awards contender.
It didn't really stick around in theaters that long either, did it?
I think it was like early September.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, another movie that's coming to HBO this week is a film called Robin Williams, Come Inside My Mind, which...
That title is weird.
Yeah. Unfortunate title. It hits HBO July 16th. So there were two major biographic documentaries that premiered at Sundance this year. Actually, more than that. RGB also premiered there.
Yeah.
But I guess involving entertainers. So those were two that I really wanted to see. Won't You Be My Neighbor was the Mr. Rogers doc, and Come Inside My Mind, which is the Robin Williams doc. So while Won't You Be My Neighbor clearly has the upper hand in way of titles, I opted instead to see Robin Williams Come Inside My Mind. Because Williams has always been somewhat of a hero to me growing up in Marin County, where he grew up, and actually he attended the same public high school I went to in the same drama class before deciding he wanted to be an actor, so I always thought of myself as kind of trying to follow in his footsteps. After seeing the film, however, I'm pretty glad I didn't. The doc goes into full detail about the extent of Williams's genius before ultimately proving how it was that genius that ended up leading to be partially his downfall. He constantly pushed himself to the edge in both life and work, and once it got to a point where his health made it he couldn't do so, I think we all know what happened, tragically. It was directed by Marina Zenovic and features a ton of laughs as well as many sobs, and I definitely recommend it if Williams's work touched your life in any way. Coming to theaters, we have another really a festival darling, I'd say, from this year's circuit, and that is Eighth Grade, which is coming on July 13th. It premiered at Sundance and made waves of positivity at pretty much every ensuing festival it played at that followed. The film had a pretty good chance at success from the get-go with the always reliable A24 behind the wheel, but it's also notable for being the debut film from popular comedian Bo Burnham. It's about a teenage girl who tries to survive the last week of her disastrous eighth grade year before leaving to start high school. Elsie Fisher is the clear standout of the picture, as she apparently portrays one of the most realistic millennial stories ever to be seen on film. I think out of all the films that have made the run of the festival circuit this year, I heard the most positive things about this film, Sorry to Bother You, and Hereditary. So if that's any indication, then this should be a pretty big hit.
I like that it's opening on Friday the 13th because eighth grade was a pretty terrifying experience.
Oh, yeah.
Me. You know, I don't know if I want to relive my eighth grade, but I'm interested in seeing hers or Bo's.
I had a pretty good eighth grade.
Yeah?
Yeah. I was president of my middle school in eighth grade.
Of the whole school?
Of the whole school.
Damn.
And then the next semester, I got reelected as vice president because you couldn't have two
terms.
That's
like a demotion. Yeah, you can't do two terms as president.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So
the campaign went back into like full force for that.
I really didn't do shit as president. Shit.
We didn't have government in our.
You didn't have like student council or anything.
Maybe, but it was so minor that it's like the Green Party, I guess.
Gotcha.
I don't know. Also opening on Friday the 13th is, I love saying this title, Don't Worry, He Won't Get Far on Foot. And it's coming from Amazon Studios and was one of the films that also opened the 2018 Sundance Film Festival. This is the latest film from Gus Van Sant, who's the occasionally mainstream, occasionally experimental filmmaker, and this one seems a little bit more mainstream-based. Of course, Van Sant has made such films as Good Will Hunting, Milk, Drugstore Cowboy, My Own Private Idaho, Elephant, and yes, the 1998 Psycho remake starring Vince Vaughn and Anne Heche, if you remember that. Based on a book by John Callahan, the film actually is about John Callahan as well and follows him, here played by Joaquin Phoenix, on the rocky path to sobriety after a life-changing accident. Callahan discovers the healing power of art, willing his injured hands into drawing hilarious, often controversial cartoons, which bring him a new lease on life. Callahan was involved with the production as well. He's given a story credit, of course. I mean, it is his life. So hopefully this is a finely tuned, somewhat faithful biopic. The film co-stars Jonah Hill, Rooney Mara, Jack Black, and Carrie Brownstein. And it feels like this could be one of those summer breakouts that does well as the other big blockbusters are duking it out at the top of the charts.
So did you like it?
I haven't seen it.
Oh, I thought you saw it.
No, I haven't seen this one.
I thought you saw it at Sundance.
I didn't see it.
Because I wanted to see it at
Sundance.
It
was at the Eccles.
Maybe it was sold out?
Because I think didn't we arrive on opening night?
Yeah.
You know? Like something where I wasn't going to be able to get there.
Damn.
In time. So I will see it. They had a Gus Van Sant retrospective at Metrograph in Chinatown recently. And I can go kind of either way.
Yeah.
So I am interested in this. Some of his more experimental ones are pretty cool. Elephant School. I heard Last Days that
Nirvana.
Kurt Cobain movie was supposed to be very good, but I haven't seen that.
I haven't seen it either.
Yeah.
Well, it's got a great cast, at least. So.
And a great title. I mean, Sorry to Bother You and Don't Worry, He Won't Get Far on Foot are the top two titles of 2018.
Sorry to Bother You is such a great title.
It really is.
Yeah. Anyways, now we're going to move on to upcoming deadlines for grants. Really just one this week as we're entering the dog days of summer, I guess.
Dog day afternoons
really.
Of summer. Yeah.
Close. I'd say August is the dog days.
Yeah. But, I mean, we don't have Liz here to tell us the weather and the dates of the seasons.
I don't know if you guys have noticed, but the film cycle tends to get a little slow during the summer, even though we're seeing some great indies come out.
Yeah. It's the crop that like premiered
it's
in
the
January
crop that already
March
premiered, right.
And then the fall circuit kicks in for our winter.
Yeah,
selections.
So we've already seen all these movies that you guys are about to see, but you know we'll get a fresh batch very soon.
Very soon.
So our one grant deadline this week is for the Sundance Creative Distribution Fellowship, and it's actually a rolling deadline, so there's not even a deadline coming up you know, this week. But if you need help releasing your film as far and wide as it possibly can go, then you should definitely let these fine people at Sundance, who were formerly called the Artist Services, be your guide. And we have actually, I think, like two podcasts, right, with these
yeah,
people?
Yeah, yeah. One is with Liz Menashill, and another was...
with Ryan and Liz's boss. So Sundance is seeking films at all budget levels featuring distinctive singular voices. They select three or four films on a rolling basis and support fellows during their initial release period from 6 to 12 months. The films will be selected by a committee comprised of the creative distribution team, along with key representatives from the Institute's feature film, documentary, and festival programs. Their evaluation process has two stages. They initially review applicants reviewing essay questions and a trailer or a clip. They then invite select applicants to submit their feature in its entirety and notify others that their project has been declined. I remember Liz talking about how important that trailer was for this fellowship. So if you are going to submit, really spend some time on that trailer. I think like they're really looking for, because it is about self-distribution, they're really looking for people who can both market their film well and have a good film. So really put some thought into how you're going to market this movie if you're going for this. So they've chosen titles like Columbus, which was a 2017 title. I think Unrest was one of them too.
Yeah, the documentary.
The documentary. And most recently, I think just like last month, they announced that Thunder Road, which we did a podcast on in May at South by Southwest, or I guess April, March maybe even.
Yeah. Which is, it's cool because Thunder Road was the feature premiered at South By. So I'm not sure if the short was at Sundance.
The short won the grand jury prize at Sundance.
Okay, because I'm wondering, do you have to be an alumni of a Sundance program?
I think
maybe.
I think it probably helps.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
But
but like the feature wasn't. It was a South By one, so that's cool.
And I think that, you know, just as a little peek into the future for the No Film School podcast, we're going to have Jim Cummings and Ben Weissner, who produced and, of course, Jim wrote and starred in Thunder Road, on the podcast to talk a little bit about a lab that they're starting, which is a shorts to feature lab. So you may or may not get to hear that at some point this summer. I know they're extremely busy, but they said that they're working on it, and maybe we'll have that for you. So that'll be cool.
And now for some festival deadlines. For Sunday, July 15th, is the Busan International Animation Festival. And the festival takes place from October 19th through the 23rd in Busan City, South Korea. Now, this is the first ever Academy Award qualifying festival to be set in South Korea, and there are competitions for animated films in five categories, which are feature, short, student, TV and commissioned, and online. And this is actually the festival's 20th anniversary, and they also have many cash prizes as well. So keep that in mind for all of you animators. And then on Monday, July 16th, is the final deadline for Doc NYC, which takes place, of course, in New York City from November 8th through the 15th. It is also an Academy Award qualifying event and is America's largest documentary festival. It takes place at some great venues like the West Village's IFC Center, Chelsea's SVA Theater, and Cinepolis Chelsea as well on 23rd Street here in New York. Voted by Movie Maker Magazine, now... not this year.
No.
Not this year. But there was a year when it was voted by Movie Maker Magazine as one of the top five coolest documentary film festivals in the world.
Oh, well, that's
that is valid. That is valid.
We'll
it's a different
see.
List.
So many lists at MMM.
Too many. That's their list machine. Doc NYC also includes the fantastic Pitch Perfect pitch event, where selected projects will be given 10 minutes to pitch, including a trailer or a clip, and 15 to 20 minutes of feedback from an industry panel as part of Doc NYC's industry programming, which is called Doc NYC Pro. Also on Sunday, July 15th, is the New Hampshire Film Festival, which takes place in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, which is October 11th through the 14th. This is also the final deadline. So the festival includes a Young Filmmakers Workshop, which is a comprehensive multi-day journey through filmmaking for 14 to 18-year-olds. So I don't know how youthful our audience is, but there could be some. There's also a screenplay competition where the winner receives two VIP-level passes to the festival and provided accommodations, as well as a prize package of a two-week writer's residency on Star Island off New Hampshire's Atlantic coast. That sounds very, very nice. The program culminates with an awards ceremony on that Thursday evening of the festival, presenting distinctive 10-pound granite awards, which are called the Grannies. Not the Grammys, but the Grannies, for New Hampshire Filmmaker of the Year, New Hampshire Documentary of the Year, and New Hampshire Performance of the Year. And because they have an award called the Grannies, it was, of course, voted one of Movie Maker Magazine's top 50 film festivals worth the entry fee.
Man, this festival sounds perfect if you're from New Hampshire and love rocks.
You're right. I guess we should have included that it sounds like you have to be a New Hampshire resident.
You don't have to.
You don't? You don't? Okay.
It's just for those...
To get a Granny.
To get one of those big 10-pound awards.
I say, if you get into the festival, move temporarily to New Hampshire. Get a Granny. A 10-pound award? I mean, that's pretty amazing.
Man, I totally forgot that New Hampshire was a state.
Yeah, so did I. Yeah, is that where Bernie Sanders is from? No,
it's Vermont.
Vermont. Yeah, I get those mixed up sometimes.
New Hampshire.
New Hampshire.
Who would have known?
It's a state?
Yeah.
I mean, some people probably, not us, but some people, I'm sure, do. You know, don't forget West Virginia. Nobody remembers West Virginia.
If you're from New Hampshire, we apologize that we forgot about your state, but, you know.
It sounds lovely. I'd love to go to Portsmouth.
Sounds great.
Portsmouth sounds like a great
Star Island.
Star Island off the Atlantic coast. I mean, that's a night for a writer's residency.
New Hampshire Film Festival. If you're looking for some people to cover your festival, and also like illuminate people about your state, you know,
we will be advocates.
Hit us up. And now on to this week's weekly words of wisdom. Ryan Johnson, who is not a controversial figure at all.
Not at all. No.
You know, I think. No. I think everyone...
I think the Brothers Bloom really yeah. set the nation on fire in terms of controversy, it's quieted down
mm-hmm,
since.
Mm-hmm. That was definitely his most polarizing film,
absolutely.
I'd say. So he had some words of wisdom for us this week about how to make a movie. In fact, he says it's the only advice that really matters. Quote, "The God's honest truth is that there's no way to do it. It is an impossible thing to do. Really, the only advice that does matter is to have a piece of material that you know and you care about, then don't stop until we make it, by any means necessary." Johnson then added, quote, "Now, I'm giving the lame general advice, but it's generally true. I really do believe it." He says that though the film industry is kind of a tank of sharks, there are reasons to be hopeful about your project. One of them is this, quote, "If you literally have something you want to make and you don't stop trying to make it until it gets made, it will get made. One way or another, at some point or another, you will get that thing made." So, if you want to make something, try and get it made.
And what was that thing he just had made that came out last year? Star Trek?
Was that?
I think
was
right
he the new Star Trek movie?
I think that was it.
Beyond? Is that what it's
Beyond.
Called? Or was it like called? Was it called Full Throttle?
Oh, God. Who directed that one? Justin Lin?
God, that movie.
I didn't see that.
Freaked me out. It was too much.
The last Star Trek?
It was going there's all this stuff happening.
Really?
Yeah.
I saw the J.J. Abrams one, and that was as far as I got.
Hey, did you know? Here's a piece of trivia. What was J.J. Abrams? Well, you would know.
I know it. I know
because
it.
Because you edited
yeah,
my article
yeah.
about it.
I know it. Yeah.
But J.J. Abrams' first feature film, Mission Impossible 3.
Wow. Just picked out of a hat a college lineup, and they said, "Hey, sir, would you like to direct
it's
this
crazy.
Feature? Yeah. Did he have Lost at that part?
I don't know. I think that they did it because...
Alias,
or they picked
right?
him because of Alias, yeah.
yeah.
And it was essentially just like a giant Alias movie. But hey, I'll plug my own article.
Do it, yeah.
About Mission Impossible, why it's good.
Why it's good. Well, that's not what the article is called, but it's close to that. But it's
like,
coming out next week.
Yeah, it's coming out. I'm going to see it.
I may see it. I definitely want to see that rock movie where is the
skyscraper?
Skyscraper. He has one leg, and the building is on fire, and Neve Campbell is shooting at people.
He has one leg?
Yeah, he's got an artificial leg.
Oh man,
because he was a soldier, and so now he has one leg, and his family's trapped in a burning building that they happen to live in. That's also an office.
There you go.
Sounds great.
So, that's going to be our shout out for this week. Is go see The Rock because we're dear friends of The Rock.
Yes.
And Tom Cruise. We're both, you know, very friendly with the show.
They could eventually switch franchises.
Next week, you can check out a podcast on the interview day, which is Monday. This is a podcast from Oakley Anderson Moore back at South by Southwest, where she interviews the team behind Tuba to Cuba, a documentary about, I think it's the Preservation Jazz Hall Band. So there's going to be some music involved, and it should be a good time for everyone. That should do it for today's show. You can read all about this stuff that you've heard
on
today's show, including Rian Johnson's words. And
so since cinema is dead, are we now just called No School?
No
or
School.
No Film? Or
yeah, No Film.
No Film. Nofilm.com will be our new title going forward.
So, you know, please subscribe, rate us on iTunes if you, you know, like the show and you believe in film's resurrection. Host Twitters, and of course, at No Film School.
I'm at Eric Lures.
I'm at Jim_John_Jim.
Jim.
And I'm just going to say it because Liz isn't here to rein me in. Poo-poo-pee-ness.
She's at Liz Film, so wish her a happy birthday.
Oh,
but
right.
Don't tell her we said it, but tell her happy birthday at
LizFilm.com.
Baby.
Baby.